Let's go ahead. We'll turn over to Genesis chapter 12. We're going to be looking at verses 10 down through verse 4 of the next chapter. Genesis 12, beginning in verse 10, the Bible says, "Now there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there. The famine was severe in the land, and when he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, 'I know that you're a woman beautiful in appearance. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, "This is his wife." Then they'll kill me, but they'll let you live. Say that you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake.' When Abram entered Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. When the princes of Pharaoh saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. For her sake, he dealt well with Abram, and he had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male servants, female donkeys, and camels. But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. So Pharaoh called Abram and said, 'What is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say, "She is my sister," so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go.' Pharaoh gave men orders concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, back into the Negev. And Abraham was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold, and he journeyed on from the Negev as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, to the place where he had made an altar at the first. And there Abram called upon the name of the Lord." You ever been afraid? I mean, really afraid? And when you're really afraid and that adrenaline kicks in, what's the two things you do? You either fight or flight, right? Those are the only two options, fight or flight. So when I was early, just before we were married, the year that my wife was finishing her college education and I was back living in Wilmer with their parents doing an internship under her dad as a pastor, I was living in the church. And so right up, they have a platform, and from the platform you could take a doorway up to one of two rooms, a Sunday school classroom, and my room was up on one of the sides up front. So it was right next to this big open auditorium, and it was kind of creepy the first few nights that I was there, living in this big, dark, scary, creaky church. We went through the summer that way. I got into the fall, and it was the first night of our Wednesday night program. So we had the kids in, running through the church. Everybody was going different directions. And it was raining that night in the fall, and it got dark early. And we sent all the kids home. Everybody's gone. And so I was turning off all the lights, and I left the light on over by the piano. And I started plinking out a tune. It was in a minor key. It was, "Oh, the Deep, Deep Love of Jesus." Just plinking it out, trying to play on the piano with very insufficient skills. And so I started working on it, and all of a sudden I heard this thump. I stopped playing the piano, looking around. Okay, I'm living in a big creaky church. So I go back and start working on it again, and I hear thump, thump, thump. And it came from the balcony. And it was really dark up there in the balcony. And so I called out, "Hello?" Nobody answered. So I left the lights on up there, and the rest of the lights are in the back of the auditorium. So I left the lights on there, and I went up to my room, and I called my dad in Wisconsin, 8 hours away. I said, "Dad, here's what's going on. There's a noise in the church, and it sounds like somebody. I'm going to look through the whole church, and I'm going to call you back in 25 minutes. Dad, if I don't call you back in 25 minutes, please call Pastor Rogers, who's right here in Minnesota." But I don't want to call him in case it's nothing. So I went through that whole church. So I got through the whole church. I went down through the basement. I went this side of the church first. So I was gaining the bravery to go up to that balcony. Nothing through the whole church. I left every single light on that I could turn on, checked in every closet, and worked my way through the whole church, and finally I got to the balcony. Started at the far side, worked toward that corner, tried to make sure nobody would slip away from me. And I finally got to that back corner. And there was one closet back behind a youth room and a Sunday school classroom, and there was one closet. And I opened that Sunday school classroom door, and there underneath the doorway in that closet, I could see a light. I was really scared. I had two options. I could either fight or flight. And I wanted to run away, but I had to live there. I had to sleep there. That my bed was there. So I had to face it. So I throw open the door, and there was nothing there. It was just the closet that housed all the kids' club program material, and somebody forgot to turn the light off. My heart, boom, 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 boom. Okay. I was so scared. I was proud of myself. I faced up to my fears, which were nothing. I've not always been that brave. As kids living in Minnesota, snow like we got this year was not a strange thing. It was the normal thing. So I was probably 9, 10 years old. So my brother's 2 years younger than me, my friend, and his older sister, all of us would be at the same bus stop. And we were waiting for the bus with some good packing snow. And so there's nothing to do, and cars are going to work. So we decided to make snowballs and throw them in front of cars. It just kind of scare cars. That was kind of a fun thing to do for a little bit. Until I hit one. Then it wasn't really fun. And all of a sudden, he slams on his brakes, and he starts to back up. At that moment, I had two choices, fight or flight. I ran around the house. He came, and he chewed out my brother and my friend. Then the bus came up, and I snuck around the house and climbed on the bus. Okay. Those are the only two options that we have. We can either face up to our fears, or we can run away from our fears. Sometimes in the same scenario, we end up doing both. Remember, it was my freshman year in college, and I lived in the same town that I went to school at, so I was living at the dorms, and I would just take all my dirty laundry over to Mom's house and do laundry on the weekends. So I didn't need to go downstairs to the basement to do laundry on Friday nights like all the other guys. For whatever reason, one of the guys came up and said, "Hey, you got to come downstairs to the basement. There's a big group down there." So I came downstairs, and here's everybody's waiting for their laundry to get done. They had gotten some boxing gloves, and they'd made a makeshift ring, and they're having boxing competition. And it was fun. I mean, they're going at it. They're boxing gloves. And so guys would get socked pretty good. And so one guy steps into the ring after one of the matches, and he was a bigger guy. I knew who he was, and I didn't want to mess with him. He was just a little bit taller than me and half again broader than me, and nobody would volunteer to go in and fight this guy. And then one of my ex-friends said, "Hey, Weber, you should do that." I said, "Thanks. Used to be a buddy of mine." And so I got in there and put those boxing gloves on, and I was used to getting picked on, and So I knew how to fight, and so the guy was throwing some pretty good punches, and I thought, man, this isn't fun anymore. And he's getting a little rougher and getting a little more aggressive. I've got one option. I've got 3 minutes that I'm stuck in this stupid ring in the basement of Pillsbury, so I've got to let this guy know that this isn't fun. And so I waited for the opportunity, and I gave him a good uppercut, and he wasn't expecting it. He rocked back. He was dazed. He didn't know what to do. The guy said, "Do it again." "No, I know this guy. He's bigger than me. I'm going to see him tomorrow." But he didn't like that very well. And so that was at like a minute and a half into the match. And for the next minute and a half, that guy was like a windmill. I wanted to run away from there as fast as I could. All of a sudden, my fight turned to just survival mode and then get out of there. But it's interesting, isn't it, how sometimes in just a moment, we can go from being willing to face our fears, and all of a sudden, we're the wimpiest little nothing that you could ever hope to be or wish that you weren't. Abraham is one of those guys. We've just seen at the very beginning of chapter 12, Abraham has made a heroic step of faith. God says, "Abraham, I want you to go away from your country to a land that I will show you." And Abraham says, "Okay." And he starts the journey. Now, he only gets part way. He gets to Haran, And his dad, who's with them, says, we're going to stay here. And so they stay there for a little while. Okay, dad dies in Haran. Abraham picks up and he keeps on going. An amazing venture of faith. And as we come to verse 9 of our text, it says, and Abraham continues journeying through the land, going down toward the south part of Israel called the Negev. A very dry land the way it is. It's desert down there. And as he moves down into the desert, more dry starts to happen. There's a famine. And as we see that Abraham makes this journey, he doesn't just journey from Mesopotamia, the breadbasket of the world, to Palestine, down to the desert of the Negev. Abram makes a journey from faith to fear. We find that it's a very short journey, and its destination is failure. The question this morning before us is, how can we successfully navigate this journey from faith to fear? Because it's a journey that's not just unique to Abraham. This journey from faith to fear is a journey that every one of us is confronted with from time to time in the Christian life. And it doesn't mean that we're not Christians when we act fearfully. It just writes a very ugly chapter in the story. So how can we navigate this successfully? And this text gives us six reminders about this journey. As we look at this journey from faith to fear, there's six principles I want us to look at this morning from this text. The first principle is this: the journey from faith to fear always begins with a notable exclusion. Verse 9, Abram journeyed on, still going down toward the Negev, and there was a famine in the land. Very next sentence: so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn, to spend a little bit of time there, not to dwell there, but to sojourn there, because the famine was severe in the land. Now, as we come to this part of the story, the problem isn't the presence of a problem. Problems are normal things for people of faith. This is part of a bigger story. Abram journeyed out of the land. He came to the land. He goes through the land, and he's faced with this problem. This story began as a faith response to God's revelation, and it suffered lapses along the way. But finally, they've reached the place where they're supposed to be. And what happens when they get there? Something bad. You ever told God yes, and it's cost you something, and you've given up stuff to follow Jesus and be obedient to Him, and you've made sacrifices, and you've run across problems, and you've fought different difficulties, and finally you get where you're supposed to be? What do you think subtly? Well, now everything's going to be all right. Maybe you don't think that out loud, but in the back of your mind, you're kind of thinking, well, God, I did that for you. Now you've got to do something for me. We wouldn't ever be so bold as to say that. But down deep in the recesses of our heart, we start to think that. And all of a sudden, Abraham is faced with a problem. He's right where he's supposed to be, and things aren't looking the way he thought that they were going to look. But the problem isn't the presence of a problem. When we think of a famine, it's just one of those ordinary things. I mean, it's like Bible stuff. That just happens, and it always happened to people. When we think famine, we don't enter into what happens in a famine. Because when there's a drought in Minnesota, what do? We get produce from Venezuela. Or we get it from Russia, or we get it from... It doesn't matter when there's a problem in one part of the world in the day and age in which we live, because there's so many different places where we can accumulate the stuff that we need to accumulate. But they didn't have what we have. They didn't do life the way we do. And it's hard for us even to imagine how to do life any differently than the way we do it. But when we're talking no water, that means there's nothing to drink. But not only is there nothing for him to drink, there's nothing for his wife to drink. There's nothing for their servants to drink. There's nothing for their cattle to drink. As he comes into this land, no drink means no food. And he has many mouths to feed. Verse 5, Abram comes with Sarah, his wife, with Lot, his brother's sons, all their possessions, which includes cattle, sheep, and so on, and all the people that they acquired in Haran. This is a big entourage. There's no food, there's no water, and all of a sudden, that which he has some substance of, his cattle, sheep, goats, oxen, camels, they're starting to die. I think the best way that we can think about this is imagine not getting a paycheck for 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, 2 months. What do you do then? You go to the bank, right? Folks, they didn't have banks. Their bank sat out in the pasture, dying. When we say there's a famine in the land, when the Bible tells us there's a famine in the land, it's hard for us to wrap our minds around how serious this is. This is big stuff. This means that there's no paycheck, there's no hope, there's no way of escape. So what does Abraham do? I like how the ESV translates it. In the middle of verse 10, there was a famine in the land, so Abram did what? Abram went down to Egypt. Is that a sin? Is he not supposed to go down to Egypt? It's not a sin. What's down in Egypt? Why would he go down to Egypt? What flows through the middle of Egypt? Not the Amazon. The Nile River. Okay, so there's a river. And so going down to Egypt, there's always fresh water. It's the breadbasket of the world. It never fails to have something to eat. And in Scripture, Egypt begins to stand for the worldly resources. And God tells his people, eventually, after Abraham, don't go down to Egypt. Don't rely on the strength of worldly support. I want you to understand that you're a people in the world, but not of the world. Your strength, your support, your refuge is in me, not in what this world has to provide. God hadn't given that instruction just yet. It makes sense that Abram was supposed would go down to Egypt. But as we come to this story, the problem isn't the presence of the problem. That's a normal thing. In fact, this isn't even an isolated incident, because testing often follows our triumphs in Scripture. Joseph is promoted to the head of Potiphar's house. What's the next chapter? In fact, before the chapter's ended, he's demoted to a slave in the bottom of Pharaoh's prison. In the Exodus, they finally leave and they gather all the material wealth of Egypt, and they're marching out and they run into the Red Sea and the army comes. Testing often follows triumph. Daniel is appointed to one of the three satraps of the land. In fact, the highest of all the satraps. And that whole chapter becomes about the story of a new law that tells nobody to pray. He's thrown in a lion's den. Okay? He gets victory. Testing follows. The apostles, they're up on the mountain with Jesus. Peter says, "This is awesome. Let's build tents here. Let's stay here a while." They come down off the mountain and nobody can cast out the demon out of the little boy. So, what's going on? Testing often follows triumph. That's why in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12, it says, "Beware, let him that thinks he stand take heed lest he..." When you think you've got it all together is when you need to be the most careful. But we need to recognize the problem is not the problem. That's a normal thing. The problem is what's missing. The problem is the absence of seeking God in the midst of the problem. There was a famine in the land, so Abram considered everything. He put all the facts together. He enumerated the pros and the cons, and he took everything into consideration except God. Except God. Well, what a dumb man. What's wrong with him? And then we look in the mirror. Oh, I guess I'm kind of like that, aren't I? I make the flow charts, I put down the pros, the cons, I'm faced with this problem, and it just makes sense. There's a river in Egypt, so I'm going to go to God first. That's not a natural thing for us, folks. And when it becomes the way we respond, it's not because you're such a brilliant person and you thought of the best idea. And it is the best idea. The only way that happens is because God is working inside of our hearts to drive us to Him. And so Abraham just skips this very important thing. And that's how the journey starts. It's not the presence of a problem, but the absence of prayer that drives Abram to the situation that we have here. You know, it's kind of a silly thing when you stop and think about it. Abraham left everything and gave God his whole future. And now that he's there, he can't even trust God for some food. It's just a little thing in the whole program. And as we look at what Jesus says, don't worry about what you're going to wear. Don't worry about what you're going to eat. Don't worry about what you're going to drink. Who knows that you have need of these things? God does. In fact, who designed you to need these things? God did. And he says, if you seek first God and his program, his kingdom, all of these things are yours because he is yours and he always takes care of those who belong to him. Yeah, so it's really dumb for Abraham to trust God with the most important thing, but not trust him with something so small as the next meal. But aren't we the same way? We trust God for salvation. God, will you take my soul and save me from eternity in hell? I know I can trust you for that. But I don't know if I can trust you for my kid's education. I don't know if I can trust you for my career. I mean, I don't know if I can trust you to help me find a spouse. God, I don't know if I can trust you to help me find a friend. God, I just got this doctor's report. I'll trust you for salvation, but I don't know about my health. We're the same way, folks. They're big things to us. And God's concerned about that. And he takes it into consideration. And that's why we need to go to him first. See, faith waits for direction. But fear becomes restless and moves and has to do something because we have to have a solution right now. We don't like that place of tension, do we? So you watch the old John Wayne movie, and you've got this nervous young cowboy. John Wayne and the nervous young cowboy are in a bad situation. They're surrounded by all the enemy. And what's the nervous young cowboy do? And he runs out and gets shot. And John Wayne keeps his cool, plugs them off as they come in, never runs out of bullets, and he ends up winning the day. Faith is willing to wait in that place where it hurts. But fear has to do something right away. Fear puts us on the move. Remember when Moses brings the children out, children of Israel, they're at the Red Sea. What does he tell them? Be still and watch the salvation of the Lord. You know what? God brings a problem into your life not to squash you, not to punish you, not to hurt you, but to discipline you. Discipline means to teach you a discipline. And that discipline is to learn to look for His salvation. When we think salvation, we always think that which is eternal. But God wants to show us that His salvation also includes His care for us right now. And so whenever God brings a problem into my life that I want to get out of, He always brings it so that I learn to wait to see the salvation of God. You've got a solution for this, but I don't know what it is. But I'm waiting to see it. So, well, fear asks, how can I get out of this? Faith words it a little bit differently. God, what do you want me to get out of this? You see the difference? When I get put between a rock and a hard place, all I want is out. But God is trying to use this to work something into my life. Abraham misses that blessing as he seeks to get out of the situation. And as we find here, it's going to always be safest at the center of God's will, even if it's in a famine, than in a palace down in Egypt, which wasn't a very good place for him to be. So the first point this morning is that the journey from faith to fear always starts with a significant exclusion, and that exclusion is not going to God and seeking His direction. Number two, the journey always leads down the path of manipulation. verses 11 through 13. He says, so when he was about to enter into Egypt, he said to his Sarai, his wife, I know you're a beautiful woman in appearance. And when the Egyptians see you, they'll say, this is his wife. So they'll kill me. They'll let you live. So because of this, tell them you're my sister, so it can go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake. Now, what he's telling her to do is a plan that he concocts while he's still back in Mesopotamia. In fact, go up to chapter 20, Genesis 20. Go down to verse 12. Because he does this again when he's with Abimelech. And Abimelech says, what in the world were you thinking, buddy? And so Abraham says in verse 11 of chapter 20, I did this because I thought there's no fear of God in this place. They'll kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is indeed my sister. She's the daughter of my father, but she's not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. So what I'm telling you is, what I'm asking you to do, Sarah, is really a half-truth. So let's tell them half the truth so they don't know the whole truth. And that was the whole point. So fear takes into account everything but God. We've looked at that. It takes into the fact that his wife was stunningly beautiful. She's about 65 years old at this time. You know, if they live, she died about 127, 130 years old. So she's not even halfway through life. She's maybe like a 35-year-old woman or something. She's still quite eligible as far as Pharaoh's concerned. His wife is absolutely beautiful. And he takes into consideration that the ways of man. How do these people operate? I'm going down to a king who has a harem, who does whatever he wants and gets rid of those that he doesn't want. I'm going to be that. So he understands the way people work. He understands the effect upon himself. He understands that this proposal is actually half true. But he doesn't take everything into consideration. He doesn't take into effect the fact that God had said, Abraham, through you, all nations on earth will be blessed. In fact, I will make of you a great nation. Many, many, many people will come from you, Abraham. Can that happen when I'm dead? No, not as far as I know. So somehow God has made a promise that many people will come from the loins of this man. God hasn't fulfilled that promise yet. God hasn't even made it possible to fulfill that promise yet. And as he starts to mull everything over in his brain and starts to pull all the facts and tries to make all the evaluations, he comes up with this plan, a plan that includes everything and covers all the bases except the fact that God had made a promise. And he puts himself in a situation that he didn't need to be in at all. Manipulation always stems from one of two motives. We see there in verse 13 why he does what he does. He says, Sarah, say you're my sister for these reasons. It will go well with me because of you, and my life will be spared for your sake. The two reasons that fear always manipulates situations are, number one, so that I can benefit myself. I want it to be well with me. Namely, let me define what I mean by well. I want to be alive. Okay. I want to benefit myself, or I want to preserve myself. Somehow, I'm going to make things work in such a way so that I get a benefit, I get an advantage, or at least I'm preserved in this situation. Do you ever do that? You wouldn't do that, would you? I do. All the time. I'm tempted to manipulate situations so that I work things so that I make sure that I get what I want. Warren Wiersbe says that while he was working for Youth for Christ, a fellow named Pete Quist would often make this statement. Faith is living without scheming. Faith is living without scheming. Scheming is, in order for me to get what I want, here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I have to do. Faith is saying, here's what I want. Nevertheless, not what I will, but your will be done. That's a hard place to be, folks. But whenever I get off that path of faith and I step onto that path of fear, all of a sudden I've transferred my goal from not my will but thine be done to I have to have my will no matter what. We wouldn't put it in those words, but that's the transaction that takes place. And it takes place down here at a heart level. And it doesn't look like, it doesn't feel, all it feels like is something's bad and I gotta get out of this. And God says, I've got you right where I want you and I've got everything under control. Just stop and talk to me about it first. So as we go through this journey, the journey always leads down the path of manipulation. Keith Krell writes, there's a few choice titles for this man that come to mind. Self-serving jerk, insensitive brute, chauvinistic pig. In addition to being a jerk, he's also an opportunistic bum. Abraham profits from his wife's moral and spiritual endangerment, and he puts everybody around him at risk. Well, wouldn't you put it like that? Well, I wouldn't have made that choice if I'd have known. But you know what, folks? When we manipulate to get our own way, we're doing the exact same thing. We've taken not only us out of the center of God's will for our lives, but whatever we do and the choices that we make, as a dad, it always affects my wife, my kids. As a pastor, it always affects my church. Guess what? You don't have to be a pastor. As a member, it always affects my church. Whenever I take myself out of the center of God's will, it always affects others. Here it affects the one that he cares most about in life, his wife. But as we move down this path from faith to fear, we see thirdly that the journey never brings you to the place that you envisioned. Abram has this plan, this great plan, as he moves down into Egypt. But we find that manipulation, when it's driven by fear, generally only considers the benefits. So if we do this, Sarah, I will get to live, and in fact, we may even prosper as a result. Looking at how this thinking may have evolved, one writer says, Abraham's motives may not be as selfish as they appear. It's likely that Abraham asked Sarah to pose as his eligible sister so that when the men of the land asked for her hand, he could stall for sufficient time for them to leave the land. It really was an ingenious plan. One of the local men would come to ask Abram for his sister's hand in marriage. Abram would consent, but insist upon a long engagement, long enough for the famine to end or whatever. During this time, Sarah would remain at Abram's house where their marriage could secretly continue, and the safety of Abraham was ensured. It seemed that the benefits were great and the liabilities were minimal. And so as Abram comes up with this ingenious plan, all he considers are the benefits. He doesn't consider the consequences, because whenever you step down that road of fear, it's always going to bring you to a place that you never anticipated. You never envisioned it was going to look like this. You never thought it was going to cost you that much. But this is what happened. It says there in verse 14, Abram entered Egypt. The Egyptians saw indeed that the woman was beautiful. The princes praise her to Pharaoh, and the woman is taken into Pharaoh's house twice in these verses. It doesn't call Sarah by name. It talks about her like a piece of meat. She's the woman. They see the woman, they take the woman, and everything's done against her. Everything's done and decided for her. And what's really happening here at this point, folks, is that God had given Abram a promise. I will make of you a great nation. We're going to find out in another few chapters that it's going to be you, and that one seed is going to come from the womb of none other than Sarah. So in order to have a pure seed, it can't be mixed, it can't be defiled with the marriage commitment, the marriage unity is absolutely essential for God to accomplish his purposes in the life of Abraham. And what Abraham has done at this moment is he's jeopardized that promise, because he's put his wife in an awfully, not only awkward, but dangerous position. So Abraham benefits from this arrangement. We come down to verse 16. Pharaoh deals well with Abraham, And he had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male servants, female servants, female donkeys, camels. The sheep, oxen, and male donkeys are for food, clothing, labor, and burdens. You can eat sheep, you can wear sheep, the oxen can pull plows, the male donkeys can carry burdens, they're sure-footed on everything. The male and female servants are symbols of significance and power. And so as the most powerful man in the whole land, Pharaoh, recognizes Abram, he honors him by giving him male and female servants. And then he gives him a couple things at the end, the female donkeys and the camels. And the idea there is probably for transportation. A female donkey is I'm told, I don't know this from experience, but it's more gentle to ride. And the camels give a nice, a smoother ride. I don't think of camels and Cadillac in the same sentence, but I'm told that those are better things to travel on. So he's benefited him from every angle. So Abraham, here's the interesting thing. Look at verse 16. Abraham gets exactly what he wants. And for her sake, he dealt what? He dealt well with Abraham. With Abram at this point. Look up at verse 13. Say that you're my sister, so that it may what? That it may go well with me. It worked. Abram's plan worked. He gets exactly what he wants, right? I want it to go well with me. It goes well with him. Wow, what a price. He could do without these benefits. They came at the cost of his wife. And then the wealth that he gains in Egypt becomes a burden in the very next chapter when he's got so much that he can't have enough in the region that he's living along with what his nephew has, Lot. And so they've got to part directions. Probably the most significant transaction that takes place at this point is when Pharaoh gives to Abram male and female servants, there's a little maid named Hagar that finds her way into the story in chapter 16. Oh, I tell you what, Abraham's benefited through his scheme. He gets exactly what he wants, but he gets more than he bargained for. And folks, that's exactly what happens when we step off that path of faith and we make that journey down the path of fear. What we find here is that, number four, the journey never takes you beyond the realm of God's intervention. It brings you to a place that you never envisioned, and it's a bad place. But the place that this road of fear brings you down never brings you beyond the scope of God's intervention in your life. So far in this story, all of the verbs of action have been by men. Abram decided to go, so Abram went. Abram came. The men saw, the men took. In fact, when it comes to Sarah, all of the verbs are passive in her regard. So they took her. She was taken by the men. All of a sudden, we're given a verb of action, and it's not men doing the acting. God steps in the scene, verse 17, and it says this. But, I love that word, but, this story is going a certain direction, but the Lord steps in and takes action by afflicting Pharaoh and his house with great plagues. The Lord steps in to remind everybody who's really in charge. It's not Abraham. In fact, it's not even Pharaoh. In charge of this whole situation is still God. You know what, folks? You and I will make mistakes in life, either on purpose or by accident, where we exclude God, and he'll bring us to that place where we never expected to be. It's going to cost us more than we anticipated it costing us. We're benefited in ways that we wish we'd never been benefited. But when we come to that place, the story's not done. You can never bring yourself beyond the scope of God's intervention in your life. Now, it'll feel like that. And Satan will tell you, you've blown it so badly this time that even God wants nothing to do with you. That's a lie from hell. And God steps in at this moment in the story and says, you know what, folks? You can go down your jolly road for a little ways, but I'm going to put a stop. I'm going to put a roadblock because I'm still the one who's writing this story. And God steps in providentially, and he starts to rewrite part of the story. It says he afflicts Pharaoh and his house, that particular place of sovereignty. Pharaoh's over the whole land of Egypt. But God says, you know what? I'm not just going to touch the whole land of Egypt at this time. We'll do that later. I'm going to touch what you really think you're in charge of, your house. You took this woman for your own benefits to make her something that you own, that you possess. You don't even own that. I do. I'm God. It says that he afflicted them with great plagues. He gets their attention. God turns up the heat in such a way that a pagan king has to say, you know what? Something's behind this that's bigger than me. That something is God. God tells us, verse 17, why he does all this. Because of Sarai, Abram's wife. That is the vehicle of blessing that God had promised to Abraham. Abram, I've got a special purpose for this woman in mind. In your refusal to obey me and your fear and your lack of faith, you're messing up my plans for her. But you will not mess up my plans for her. She belongs to me too. And so do you. And I love you both. And he steps in and takes control of the situation because of his love for his people. God steps in to preserve the integrity of the messianic line. The Messiah, we found out about in Genesis chapter 3, the seed of the woman, is a feature of God's story that requires no help from Egypt, no help from worldly intervention, and it demands absolute separation from the world. In the world, but not of the world. And God says, listen, I'm writing a story here, Abram, that I don't want you to mess with, because this can't be tinted with anything other than promise. And my work at work in my story. So no action taken by man, even our failure, can derail God's program, God's purpose, God's promise. What's his promise? Hebrews 13, verse 5. Be content with such things as ye have, for he hath said, I will never leave you. You ever really blown it? I mean, you know it was sin. Others know it was sin. And you find yourself at a place, you say, you know what? It's done. It's over. I'm shelved. God maybe could have used me before, but not anymore. Huge encouragement of the life of Abram, and this story in particular, is that you can never bring yourself to the place where God cannot intervene. A fifth reminder as we look at this, the path from faith to fear. The journey always results in utter humiliation. Yes, God works, but there are consequences. Verse 18. So Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this you have done? You're a husband, and you used your wife to get benefit for yourself. He doesn't put it in this terms, but remember what God had said to Abram back in early verses 1, 2? Through you, all nations on earth shall be what? Through Abraham, all nations on earth will be blessed. Does God bless Pharaoh because of Abraham at this point? Abram becomes a curse to Pharaoh at this point. He didn't even accomplish the purpose that God had for him. So he gets this embarrassing interrogation. What is this you've done? And the way the wording of it is, it reflects a lot of when God comes to his people, Adam and Eve, back in the garden. What have you done? It's a legitimate question. It's a question that a pagan man now points his finger in Abram's face and says, what have you done? What were you thinking? He goes on and says, why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you in fact say that she was my sister? So I took her for my wife. Three questions Pharaoh asks. Why? What were you thinking? Why'd you do this? How many answers do we get from Abram? Count them up there. None. What can he say? He's dead to rights. Pharaoh's right. What was I thinking? Can you imagine being in that place? It's humiliating. And so he's given a commission. Come down to the next verse. End of verse 19. Now then, here is your wife. Get out of here. So Pharaoh gives orders to his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. Privately, Abram, you disgust me. Get out of here. Publicly, guys, see that this guy goes and he doesn't come back. Did God work? Yes. But because Abram stepped down this path of fear, Abram could not tell Pharaoh anything about the good and faithful God that he served. You know what? Same thing's true for you and for me. When I choose to manipulate things in my life, and I get all bent out of shape because things don't go the way I think they should go, and I want out of it right now rather than waiting for what God can give me through this situation, people look at my life and say, you know what? I want nothing to do with your God if that's what faith in him looks like. Abraham loses an opportunity to be a beacon and to touch a ruler of the world at this moment. And he sent him away. As we come to chapter 13, the final point we have to keep in mind is that the journey from faith to failure never brings you to a final destination. Never. It's humiliating. It costs me more than I was planning on. God has intervened. But it never brings me to a final destination. So it says in verse 1 of chapter 13, so Abram left Egypt. He went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had. And he went back to where he started to take the wrong path. We see up in verse 9, he's going toward the Negev. And it's in the Negev that he experiences this tension, this problem. And he makes this decision. And he goes the wrong direction. And he gets caught. And he gets turned around, and what does he do? He goes back to the same place where he made the wrong decision, but this time he makes the right decision. Verse 2. Abram's rich in livestock, silver, and gold. We're given this as kind of a foreshadow of what's about to happen in this chapter, but verse 3. So he journeys on from the Negev as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai. He went to the place where he had made an altar at the first. You know what? This whole story that we've just read. How many altars do we find Abram building down in Egypt? Not one. Not one. This whole chapter of Abram's life excludes God, other than God choosing to include himself in the story. But he doesn't allow his servant to stay there. And when he gets spanked pretty good, he goes back to the place where he made the wrong decision, and he starts to make the right decision. He says, you know why I got in this mess? I got in this mess because I walked away from God. And with that, a new chapter starts in the life of Abraham. So he brought him to the place where he had made an altar at the first, and there Abram called upon the name of the Lord. And we're off into another story. And it's a story where Abram is going to succeed. He's going to shine. And we're going to use him as a good example and say, boys and girls, be like this. But you know what? It took him a long time to get there. It took an embarrassing chapter. Now here's the thing, folks. New beginnings are always possible with God. Praise God. But new beginnings are never meant to be a license for us. But they are meant to be an encouragement to us. You know, folks, this was written because this is what we look like, not just Abraham. It's embarrassing how much we look like this. Some of us walk this path to such a degree that we could write the atlas. We could show what this journey looks like. We own the rights to the map. Some of us don't walk this very often, and when we do, we sit down in the middle of the road and we wonder if there's ever a way back. Some of us deceive ourselves and try to deceive others by using words like saying we're analytical or I'm just trying to be responsible. Whatever it is, folks, this isn't a story just about Abram. This is a story about me. And this is a story about you. Will you do something with this before God this morning? Will you let Him do something with this for you?